Hello and welcome to another episode of a Tisket Tasket podcast. I'm your host, Gina, and today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. As you know, I have an interest in folklore. I talk about attending the American Folklore Conference and being part of their community. And today I thought I would review an article that I found extraordinarily interesting that talks about the definition and the functions of folklore. This is kind of a laid-back episode. I'm going to do minimal editing. I just wanted to add some bonus content because things have been kind of busy lately, so I thought I would record about something I've been working on because I just haven't had time to look at nursery rhymes. So stay tuned for this episode. We are going to talk about the four functions of folklore, which was an article published by William Bascom in the 1954 The Journal of American Folklore, in the fall, October to December edition. If you'd like to know the definition of folklore and its context, stay tuned.
Welcome to the enchanting world of nursery rhymes, where childhood memories and timeless tales intertwine. Join us on the A Tisket Tasket podcast as we embark on a delightful journey through the rich history and captivating origins of beloved nursery rhymes. Tune in for an exploration that will delight nursery rhyme enthusiasts and folklore aficionados alike. And now your host, Gina.
It's springtime, which means a lot of call for papers, a lot of call for conference presentations are out, and so I've been working on my CFP for the American Folklore Conference, as well as publications and all sorts of other things. And as I was working on my abstract, I was really struggling with defining folklore and figuring out its context, because whenever you enter a community, you're learning a whole new language fluency, and you're learning definitions and context and things of that nature. So as I write in my abstract that I'm working on, I say, as any other community newbie, I struggle with grasping shared understandings, definitions, and culture. I had spent a year of independent research on nursery rhymes before I even became aware of an academic community of folklore. So as I anoint myself with the various definitions of folklore, such as the wonderful 1959 Bascom quote that I'll talk about here in a minute, I start seeing the study of folklore applicable everywhere. And I'm hoping for the AFS conference to speak on Jimmy Buffett and his life, which is so completely different than nursery rhymes, but is still very important to me. I'm at the point where I'm understanding context and understanding definitions, and I'm learning this language and definitions. And so folklore, I wanted to make sure that I was using definitions and functions and context appropriately so that when I go to publish or speak on it in this podcast or elsewhere, I'm speaking from a place of authority. In a 1959 article, the same author, Bascom, has the following quote, which I just love. It's so poetic. It reads like a poem that talks about his definition of folklore, and he was renowned folklore scholar, especially in bridging the gap between social anthropology and folklore. So here's his quote from a 1959 article. Whenever a lullaby is sung to a child, whenever a ditty, a riddle, a tongue twister, or a counting out rhyme is used in the nursery or at school, whenever sayings, proverbs, fables, noodle stories, folk tales, reminiscence of the fireside are retold, wherever, out of the habit or inclination, the folk indulge in songs and dances, in ancient games, in merrymaking, to mark the passing of the year or usual festivities. Whenever a mother shows her daughter how to sew, knit, spin, weave, embroider, make a coverlet, braid a sash, bake an old-fashioned pie. Whenever a farmer on the ancestral plot trains his son in the way long familiar, or shows him how to read the moon and the winds to forecast the weather at sowing or harvest time. Whenever a village craftsman, carpenter, carver, shoemaker, cooper, blacksmith, builder of wooden ships, trains his apprentice in the use of tools, shows him how to cut mortise and peg in a tenon, how to raise a frame house or a barn, how to string a snowshoe, how to carve a shovel, how to shoe a horse and shear a sheep. Whenever, in many callings, the knowledge, experience, wisdom, skill, the habits and practices of the past are handed by example or spoken word by the older to the new generations, without references to book, print, or school teacher, then we have folklore in its personal domain, at work as ever, alive and shifting, always apt to grasp and assimilate new elements on its way. That was an article published by Bascom in the Journal of Folklore Research. And again, I just love it. It's so poetic and absolutely a wonderful, gorgeous representation of all of the things that folklore represents. And in essence, he's saying that folklore is the passing down of culture and context. And so I wanted to talk a little bit more about Bascom's view of folklore and how he defines it. And I found this article so intriguing, the functions of folklore, that I just wanted to spend a podcast episode talking about it. In this article, his main purpose is to show the most effective way to bridge the gap between the anthropological and the humane points of view towards folklore. And he says the way to do that is through the common concern with common problems, rather than relying, as in the past, on a common interest. And he says that the three most common concerns to anthropologists and therefore folklorists are as follows. Number one, the social context of folklore. Number two, the relations of folklore to culture, which might have been phrased as the cultural context of folklore. And three, the functions of folklore. And so he talks about kind of the transitions between the anthropology studies and folklore. To give you a little bit of a background, folklore studies have been around for hundreds of years. I talk a lot about early collectors of nursery rhymes from the 19th century, even the 18th century, and it's my hope to one day write a book about these early collectors and how people started to recognize nursery rhymes as important to collect and to study from a historical point of view. And anthropology studies have been around forever, right? As long as we've had a past, we've wanted to study it. And there seems to have always been sort of a friendly competition or argument between anthropology studies and folklore and how to define the two of them and how to separate them. And frankly, it kind of makes me roll my eyes because it's a bit of a squabble from a perspective of people looking for funding, right? And academics, we pay attention to that because we want to get paid for what we do. We need a job. And so I feel like folklorists have spent a lot of time in the early days and in the early 20th century trying to stand on their own merits, because at the time, anthropology studies were in vogue in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And so therefore, they got more funding. And folklorists are like, hey, we're important too. We need our own funding. And nowadays, when you look at academics and funding, history and humanities are so underfunded, which is a whole other rant. I don't know if Bascom's argument would be as relevant today, just because we don't have the same sort of rivalry. But in any case, that's why he wrote this article, is basically saying, like, folklore is its own department, its own field of study, and we need to be clear in our definitions so that we can stand apart and we can clearly define what we're doing. And that's what he does. And he says very clearly that anthropologists fail to use oral narratives in studying, and that's incredibly important to understand the context of culture, and that's one of the main differences between folklore and anthropology. One of his first points in the article is that he really wants to be clear about the social context of folklore, because folklore cannot be understood outside of social context. Like, you can't study folklore in a vacuum. And one of the biggest issues that early folklorists had is not considering our modern biases when studying things of the past, because our modern biases, our modern taboos, our modern communities have completely different social contexts and social structures. Well, maybe not completely different, but different social structures than people of the past. And if we look through our lens with a modern bias, then we can not only miss important social contextual clues, but also misrepresent them. And so that's one of the first things that Bascom talks about. And so he does a very good job discussing like what social context in folklore is. And he says there are six ways social context is folklore. So the first, he says, when and where the various forms of folklore are told. Two, who tells them, whether or not they are privately owned, and who composes the audience, which I think is really important, this idea of ownership, because we're passing down things orally and we have to say, okay, who owns them? Who owned them? Where did it derive from? Things of that nature. Three, dramatic devices employed by the narrator, such as gestures, facial expressions, pantomime, impersonation, or mimicry. So that's definitely different from anthropology because there is that acting nature of it, which is important to folklorists because that says a lot about context. Like the idea of gesture in oral narratives, it's very important to consider in social context, to understand social context. So he continues by saying, four is the audience participation in the form of laughter, assent, or other responses. Running criticism or encouragement of the narrator singing or dancing or acting out parts in the tale. Again, that's so unique to oral narratives or live performance is audience participation. And so we're not looking at something static. We're looking at something that's moving and changing. And we're looking at the dynamics of change, the dynamics of context. And so that's what makes folklore much different than the study of just history. He continues to says, number five is categories of folklore recognized by the people themselves. So folklore can't exist without some sort of social conformity or social acceptance, right? So folklore can't be disagreed on by a community because then it's not folklore. It's just a tale that someone told that didn't take off. It's like a joke that's not funny. And that's another convention of folklore social context. And finally, number six is the attitudes of the people toward these categories. And then again, that goes back to, do the people agree that this is a performance or a piece of folklore? Because otherwise, it's not. And they have to, the audience has as much as a role as the narrator in creating folklore, because otherwise it won't get passed down. It won't become a part of a social heritage or a social culture. And so Bascom, I think, really hits the nail on the head in the early parts of his article by saying, like, folklore is unique because it's about performances, and performances can't happen without an audience. And those two things have to be understood in a social context, in a community, because if not, then it's not folklore, it's static. And I've definitely talked a lot about this with nursery rhymes. I've talked about like how important nursery rhymes are for family dynamics in teaching children. And so in this case, it's important to note like these nursery rhymes had to have, there's something to them to be popular enough to be passed down for hundreds of years. Because if they weren't popular, they wouldn't have been orally passed down to us. So we think about those ancient nursery rhymes like London Bridge is Falling Down or Hickory Dickory Dock that are literally hundreds of years old. So one of the questions to ask is, what makes them so catching to society that they keep being passed down? And I think that's a question that people who study folklore could ask for hundreds of years and continue to ask and continue to write about and to kind of try to define that. And maybe it can't be defined, and that's fine as well. But to continue on, he says, you know, text is a part of folklore too, but he says the text, of course, is extremely important, but without the context, it remains lifeless. And I really like the fact that he uses the term lifeless. Because folklore is life. Folklore is movement. And I love the idea that folklore is alive. Not to say that, because I, used to study literature in the past, literature isn't alive, but folklore, I think, is so unique and so much fun because of community involvement. And if you understand the word prescriptivism, it has to be from a prescriptivist point of view because it can't exist without context. And I think maybe this dynamic of folklore, that's what it makes it so fun to study and understand, because it has to be considered in its context, and you have to consider your own context and in which you are currently living to understand folklore, so you don't accidentally add those biases. And I talk a lot about that too when I'm talking about Cecil Sharp's collection of these nursery rhymes in Appalachia, where he naturally puts his own biases when he doesn't talk about the African American communities or the German communities. It's a natural biases that hinders his research because he is a product of his own time and he misconstrues some social context because of his own social construction. And I think Bascom in the 1950s really warns scholars about it. And it's unfortunate when I'm trying to piece together a historical narrative in 2024 when these scholars in the early 1900s don't consider it. But in any case, he also talks a lot about, and Bascom talks like the difference between the fairy tale legends and myths. And that's not really something that I'm super interested, but he says that familiar summary should show the importance of the recording of the native categories of folklore. And so he's basically saying, like, it's important to understand how a specific culture defines categories. And that's not something that I really struggle with because I'm specifically looking at nursery rhymes and nursery tales. But in any case, if you're interested in folklore, he says, the times and places they are told, the identity of the narrator and the composition of the audience, the factor of private ownership, the style of recitation and the participation by the audience, the attitudes of the people, and even the functions are to be, to a considerable extent, unique or distinctive for the various categories for which they're recognized. So those social contexts that he talked about before are different when we consider fairy tales, are different when we consider legends, and are different when we consider myths. And he says, be careful of that. If you're defining folklore in categories, you need to consider that all of these social contexts might change depending on what category you're looking at. But then he goes on to talk about as folklore is a mirror to culture. And again, I've talked a lot about this in my previous episodes, and that's one of the things that made me so interested in nursery rhymes to begin with. If you listen to my Hickory Dickory Dock episode or any of my episodes about sheep, I get really excited to talk about this because one of the things I was like, why are there so many nursery rhymes about sheep? And it's because I didn't know how important wool farming was to Great Britain in the Middle Ages to the early modern ages. And because I didn't know that, I didn't understand the nursery rhymes and the social construction and the mirror that they had because of it. And so I thought it was really cool that not only was I learning about the history of these nursery rhymes, but in the same time, because they are a mirror to history, I got to learn about important economical histories of England. And that's not something I set out to do. So Bascom talks about this. He says, to extent to which folklore-like language is a mirror of culture and incorporates descriptions of the details of ceremonies, institutions, and technology, as well as the express or beliefs and attitudes. And it goes beyond that. Like, folklore talks about any aspect of society or culture that you can think of. It talks about history. It talks about the economic history, talks about political history, talks about food history. And I talked a lot about this in my AFS conference presentation last year. Like, nursery rhymes should be studied because they talk about any aspect of life that you can think about, and folklore does the same. Folklore captures the essence of culture that cannot be understood through static items. So, like, if you go to a museum and you see a cooking pot, yes, you can understand about the culture through that cooking pot, but you don't understand, like, the social context behind it or the culture behind it. You don't know what they were cooking. You don't know what they were talking about around the campfire when they were cooking or the oven when they were cooking. And nursery rhymes and other parts of folklore, when you're studying that, that's what you get. And that's what's really excited for me. That's what really sparks my interest. And Bascom talks about that through his use of the discussion of a mirror of culture. And of course, he says that folklore is important because it offers clues to defunct practices, practices that we don't do anymore, that don't happen anymore. So Baba Black Sheep talks about these tax brackets that no longer exist, right? So we can understand these economics through nursery rhymes, through this folklore that no longer happens. And if we take our biases out as much as we can understand it in a more holistic way. The second thing he says that why folklore is important is that it offers clues to past events into archaic customs. Archaic customs is no longer an actual practice, and it may provide a meaning getting at the esoteric features of culture which cannot be approached in any other way because we're not part of that culture. So we're understanding culture from an outsider's perspective, and we can do that through folklore. Further, it may provide a means of getting at and revealing the effective elements of culture, such as attitudes, values, and cultural goals, and moreover, may verbalize those in a form which needs only to be translated and quoted as evidence of a consensus of opinion. And this really, he talks a lot about this when he talks about taboos, which I'll get about in a minute. This really like grinds my gears when I'm reading people like Sharp and Halliwell, because I feel like their own personalities sometimes overshadow what they're studying because they can't help put their own cultural biases on whatever they're studying. And that almost ruins the history that they're studying, because if they're putting their own cultural biases and social context on what they're studying, it ruins the essence of the original. So if folklore is talking about a cultural taboo in that culture, it may or may not be a taboo in our culture. And so if we are putting our feelings on their culture, it's more difficult to understand, if that makes sense. And so that's why Bascom and others talk about why it's so important to understand folklore and to study folklore, is because we get to look at culture through a different perspective and gleam what was taboo and what wasn't, or what was important and what wasn't. And it's just another unique fact about it. He also talks about like different schools of folklorists, which I'm not really going to get into. But one of the things I chuckled about was that the problem with American anthropological or folklorists is that we like, I'll just read this quote. It says, "Finally, the American anthropological quote-unquote school has been as collected in this respect as usual, refusing to accept any single explanation for the many different cultures and historical situations without first examining the specific facts bearing upon each case." And when I annotate my article, my annotation says, LOL, Americans can't commit and therefore are bad. And so I just kind of had a chuckle because, yet again, I talk about this too. Like when you're reading historians, and I talk about this with reading Opie, you can kind of like see their humor if you read enough of their work or see their biases. And so I don't know if Bascom was American or not. I haven't looked up his history, but I just, from that reading that paragraph, it was really funny. I feel like he was really judging American schools. And I take pride in that. Like, I take pride in the fact that I have to look at things at a case-by-case basis. But in this article, he kind of says that it was bad. And as he continues, before he even starts talking about the functions of folklore, he does say that folklore shouldn't draw conclusions about the context of different cultures, especially if they're different from their own. So he says that certainly it can no longer be possible to regard folklore simply as a true and accurate mirror of culture, or to ignore the basic importance of investigating the actual behavior in any society, the ideal patterns of any culture, or the attitudes of any people whose folklore is to be interpreted. Even if there are societies in which contrast between folklore and culture are completely absent, this fact in itself is important to know and attempt to explain. And I think that's a really important note to make, is, again, with social biases, with folklore, and kind of taking folklore with a grain of salt, too. So when he talks about, like, folklore isn't a true mirror, it's because of his functions. I'll get to that. And, like, one of the things that folklore needs to have is the idea of the unusual or impossible. And so, like, you have to understand, okay, maybe this this folklore story is apocryphal or just maybe an over-exaggerated or elements of it are added in for dramatic effect and not necessarily what that culture believes. So that really gets into what he's describing as the four functions of folklore. Finally, right? I've only been rambling here for 26 minutes and I'm only getting into the key of the articles, but it was really important for Bascom to kind of establish all these facts before he gets into it, because he's just like, look, there have been all these arguments, but we need to take these things into consideration before we can even talk about the functions of folklore and how folklore should be viewed. So in this article, his four main functions of folklore that he argues are number one, folklore may mirror culture, but also contains the unusual or impossible. So it's an exaggeration of a true culture. Number two, folklore validates a community or culture. So again, the community must buy into the folklore for it to become folklore. Otherwise, it's just poorly told story. Number three, folklore plays a part in a community's education or pedagogy. And this is, I think, very clearly stated in nursery rhymes or especially fairy tales. So if we think of Grimm's fairy tales, that Aesop's fables, there's story we tell children as maybe to scare them into behaving or scare them away from dangerous things. I always like the Celtic folk tales, for example, you know, don't go into the dark forest or you're going to be eaten by a bear. Things like, you know, real fears that communities had for their children or the community were told through folklore as, you know, tools, pedagogical tool. And so Bascom says that this is a function of folklore. And number four, that folklore argues for social approval and conformity. Folklore, especially these stories, say what is right in a society and what is wrong in a society. And again, it goes back to, we have to be careful as scholars not to appropriate or not to tell our audiences, you know, to go literally, as I was getting to the good part, talking about these four functions, my microphone died and I didn't realize it. So I rambled on for another 15 minutes before I realized I was no longer recording. Which is very problematic because I have so much more to say. But looking at my timestamp, I think what I'm going to do is stop here for now and then do a second section where I talk about how nursery rhymes fit these four functions. So that way I can kind of express my thoughts and use Bascom as a framework to discuss my own studies, which is essentially what I'm doing for this year's American Folklore Conference, where I'm talking about how Jimmy Buffett and his legacy fits these four functions. But in any case, I really like this article. Again, this was published in the Journal of the American Folklore in the fall edition of 1954. And it's called Functions of Folklore. And between recording this and then finding out my microphone was dead, I actually looked him up. And he was an American anthropologist and folklorist. And he was actually president of the American Folklore Foundation when he wrote this article. So this was the address at the El Paso meeting, which makes it, I think, even more poignant, because here was a person with power in the community. Using this as the address was a great way to kind of talk about what the society stands for as a whole. It actually makes me feel a little bit more comfortable about using it as a framework as well, but that's kind of an aside. But in any case, stay tuned where I talk about how these four functions definitely appear in nursery rhymes and how nursery rhymes are excellent examples of folklore. But in any case, stay tuned. Again, I've been very busy, so I'm trying to get to this podcast when I can, and I'm trying to be good about working on publication writing as well. Just, you know, been busy, that's life. But I would love to hear feedback. I'm not hearing much feedback anymore, so please email me at info@tisketasketpodcast.com, link in the description, to tell me your thoughts. Let me know what you like about the podcast, what you want to see more of. Check out my new website. It is a little bit more design friendly. I'll be adding to the blog because I need to change some of the format so it's easy to read, because when I changed the website, of course, all my blog structure went away, which is problematic. Websites, man. But yeah, let me know what you think and continue to listen, where I'll talk about the weirdness of nursery rhyme and the amazingness of folklore.
Thank you for listening to a Tisket Tasket podcast. We hope you learned something valuable today. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss a future episode. If you found value in today's content, please share with others and consider leaving a review. Also, follow Gina on all social media platforms, and we'll see you next time.